Twinkies. More fun than a room full of wombats. Able to reach huge audiences with a single broadcast. Yes, it's the Outdoor Journal Radio Show. And now, another exciting episode in the adventures of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Hey, how you doing, folks? Thank you for joining us. I'm Angelo Viola. He is Peter Bowman. And our usual array of suspects. Volvo over there behind the camera. Nick, as usual, is not there. And, of course, Dean Taylor, our producer, over in the corner. Welcome to the program. This is one of those shows that we ask to get more of, and we don't always get what we ask for. But we every once in a while, we love a little lighter episode where we get a chance to talk about a subject without a guest. Not that we don't want guests on the show, but this is a case where we just get a chance to talk about either a favorite or not so liked subject that we can just pound away at will and not be encumbered by the burden of somebody else.
I like that.
How's that?
And apparently, from what our producer, Mr. Dean, says sometimes, that a lot of our audience likes the sit-downs, as you and I have in a little BS session, you know? So
they're normally our best ones, according to the audience.
According to the audience. And now, sometimes we don't think they're all that good, but that's okay.
But you know what? That happens in the Fish in Canada show as
well.
We'll go out there and we'll shoot a show. We'll come back and say, oh, my God, Ange, that was shit. Well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And Ange say, I don't know what we're going to do. We can go out and shoot again. Let's see what we got. And then all of a sudden, fast forward to 6 months later, and it's on the TV, and all of a sudden, you know what? To us, we go, it didn't look that bad. I know, but the fish were small. And then the audience goes, God, I love that show. You guys talked about this, that, and the other.
And why? Because usually those are the shows where the fishing was not great, and certainly what was caught was not big. And I think the reason that those shows work so well because we don't have the encumbrances called fish. It gives us an opportunity to maybe talk about other things, and that's what the audience loves. And,
You know what? Maybe
I think we should stop fishing on the show. I think. Personally, I think there should be no more fishing on the Fish in Canada show. It should be called A Couple of Guys Who Used to Fish Canada.
The Send Us Question Canada show. Send Us Questions Canada show.
By the way, I don't know whether you noticed my lovely
lovely
new shirt.
Give me a hell yeah.
You got that right. Brand new. That's a bunch of bullshit.
That's a bunch of bullshit.
Yes.
Thank you. There you go.
So are people going to be able to get those, purchase those?
Very soon.
This nice.
Was just designed. This is the first prototype. I believe that within this week, they will be up on the site. So check them out.
There you go, folks.
You can proudly wear it. It's got an Outdoor Journal logo down at the bottom here.
How about a little Christmas gift? If you get on on it real quick, they could probably order that for a Christmas gift for an avid Outdoor Journal radio podcast listener fan. You know.
Wow.
You know,
give me another one of those.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
Thank you.
Wow, that's cool.
I want a bullshit button right here.
That's cool. Oh, hey. Buddy, you were born with a bullshit button.
I want
a
bullshit button right there. Every time I want it, I want to push it there. Like, I don't know what I have to do. I don't want to.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
That's right.
Timmy's, his voice is so good on that. Buncha. And they got it spelled too. Buncha.
Buncha.
On the shirt. Buncha. That's a bunch of bullshit.
Check out the fishingcanada.com website, the store, actually, shop.fishingcanada.com. Whatever it's
That's
called.
That's it. Shop.fishingcanada.com.
There you go. Go there. And you too can own one of these lovely, that's a bunch of bullshit shirts.
Along with all this array of other beautiful items that we have available there. So.
That's correct. Sales are ongoing in terms of stuff that's discontinued, in terms of stuff that we deemed to has gone through its cycle. So the thing is, you go there often because you'll see that their sales will crop up periodically without any notification. Just happens.
Yeah.
Listener feedback, Mr. Bowman.
Listener feedback.
By the way, before we get into listener feedback, just want to remind folks that we still do appreciate anything like subscribers. Give us some kind of a
hell yeah.
Give
me a hell yeah.
Thank you.
Did I catch you while you're eating? I'm sorry.
No, it's just gum.
Oh, it's just gum. What else can folks give us that we need? How can they show love?
Reviews are the best. They help us out a lot. Emails, though, are always great. You might, I might put one in the, the podcast.
Feature your email in the podcast.
Well, we're coming. Yeah, we're going to have a listener email here in a minute. So,
so all kinds of love, right?
And yeah,
even posting on Instagram, if they Instagram and Facebook, if they even put comments in there, it helps us. All of it helps, right? Because we can use that to
rankings. They give us. They can do that as well.
They can do that in the podcast, right? On the Apple version.
On
of the
Apple.
Yeah. Just let us know you're out there. That's all.
Yeah.
No big deal.
You're nice.
Come on now.
All right. Listener feedback. That's why I started with that.
You're working on that, right?
I'm working on that right now.
Yes.
This is from listener feedback from episode 94.
Schreimer?
Yeah. Schreimer. Went to winterize. Andrew Schirmer.
Schirmer. Yeah.
Schirmer.
Yeah, I think you're right. Schirmer.
Yeah.
Yep.
From Oshawa.
Boy, we always have a hard time. We have a hard time with all our listeners.
I know. Why can't they all be Smiths?
You know,
John Smith. I think everybody should just sign it John Smith from now on.
That's it. That's
help
it.
A couple of old
you
guys.
Want, somebody's going to do it. They're going to laugh their ass off when they're doing it, too. They're going to love it.
Andrew Schirmer from Oshawa says, I know Angela wants full names and locations.
There you go. You asked for it. Otherwise, you'd have just put down Andrew right. S., you see?
Okay. So. Just wanted to say two things. You guys are continuing to make awesome content. That's what we like to hear.
Arriba.
See? On the show and the Outdoor Journal Radio podcast and channel. No surprise there.
Thank you
very much, Andrew. Appreciate it.
That's awesome.
And second, I just listened to episode 94 about winterizing the boat. And I wanted to give you a tip about deterring rodents from chewing down on wiring. Because if you remember on that episode, we had Steve Tate on there. He's our expert when it comes to anything motorized. And one of the things, the comments that he made and I made as well, was the fact that rodents do tend to chew cables and wires and whatnot. So we had a couple of ideas on how you could prevent that from happening. But Andrew says, I used to work at Crown Rust Control for many years, and a non-advertised benefit of the oil product that that's used is that mice and squirrels, etc., don't chew on electrical components after they've been sprayed with it.
Wow. I think that's amazing.
Ooh,
it makes sense because it's a petroleum-based product, obviously. That's what Crown uses, oil. And the rodents don't like it. So when they go spraying inside the, all those little nooks and crannies,
mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. He goes ahead to say, we had many customers who would get their farm or cottage vehicles sprayed just for that specific purpose. In other words, not for rust prevention, but for rodent prevention on the wiring. And the T40 product is environmentally friendly and non-flammable, so there is no risk of it damaging components.
There's a great tip right there. I looked it up. It's just a can. It looks like a WD-40 type of can, right? Just spray like that. And I don't know if you can. And remember, Crown with a K, as if you're looking it up.
So
Crown with a K.
I'm a little confused because he says at the beginning that it's the oil product. Crown Rust Control
spray. It's a spray can.
To benefit oil product, but then it's non-flammable and environmentally friendly.
Huh. Well,
all right. Who knew?
Not me.
I don't know about the flammability, but I'm sure there's somehow they must have it tested. If they're saying it's environmentally friendly, they must have it tested.
Yeah, you would think it would have to be environmentally friendly. They go spraying the bottoms of cars with it. Then cars are out in the environment driving all over the place. It's got to be. So there you go. And now you're saying you can actually buy this product?
I looked it up and I saw a can of it for sale.
Excuse me.
Or a can of it advertised. I don't know if it was for sale or not. I just had to quickly look to see what it looked like for, if we were going to do it in our boat.
Yeah.
Instead of getting somebody professional to do it. And there was a little can. They're just like,
there you go.
Give her a shot.
So. You heard it first here on Outdoor Journal, by the way, just so that you know. That's fantastic. Well,
heard it first from Andrew on Outdoor Journal.
Well, and we appreciate that, Andrew.
He's
Thank
the man.
You very much.
If Thanks, buddy.
You've got suggestions like that and give us a little feedback, by all means, just do it at info Is that where they do this stuff?
Or Instagram. I think this one was on Instagram. So I pull them from everywhere.
So anywhere you want to reach us, ask your question or make your point, it will make its way into the 45-gallon drum that Dino rescued from the scrapyard.
And it was a rusty old drum, eh?
You cleaned it all up.
You used Crown rust proofing. You used Crown rust proofing on it.
All right. Okay.
And then no mice in there anymore.
Yeah, and he put a bunch of holes. He perforated with a bunch of... He did a lot of work. Like, he drilled every single hole in that thing by hand. So.
And he puts all the letters and stuff in there.
And there's not a drop of rust or any rust stain or anything on the letters. And
I love it.
It's all white, perfect white papers and stuff.
The podcast network, Outdoor Journal, is a network as well as a show. For those of you who may not be aware of it, we have several wonderful productions under that banner. One of them is the Under the Canopy.
Our good buddy Jerry Ouellette.
Former Minister of Natural Resources, is one of our podcasters. And Under the Canopy deals with everything under the canopy. Outdoors, mostly edible stuff.
Yes.
On episode 19, particular interest is canning and preserving, an episode that he did with Bev DeLinardo.
DeLinardo. Look at us getting these names pretty good, pretty accurate.
DeLinardo.
I like that name. That's cool. How altitude affects how you preserve goods, how to tell if something is spoiled, accounting for acidic
hold
levels.
Hold it. How altitude affects how you preserve your goods.
Well, that's
apparently it takes longer to set or something like that. I was in on the podcast. I should know exactly.
Right.
But he said he sent, or Bev was saying she sent some preserves to her daughter who lives in Calgary. And when it got there, it was popped, like it wasn't sealed properly because of the altitude change from Toronto to Calgary.
Well, sure, the pressure.
Yeah. So they talk about that.
But that makes a whole lot of sense.
Everything on that show makes a lot of sense.
Well, yeah.
But you don't think about that until right now. Have you ever talked about that until right now?
No, but that's the same reason your ears, when you get up there, sometimes your ears are problematic.
Oh, my God. Remember how bad I used to get?
Oh, you used to be like a little child.
Oh, my God.
I used to have to cradle them in my arms when we went on a plane.
I had a needle that big. It was in the one side or the other. The first time I started flying, and it just felt like somebody just got in that one ear. It just felt like it was just a needle that whole time flying that plane. And it'd take me like 2 days to get, when I got on the ground, it'd be 2 days. I finally got used to it. Now I can fly, but it was the worst pain.
And then he took it to the next level. He used to run into the same problem when we would go
scuba diving. Holy shit. And that one I never got over. The only time I ever got over that was we did two dives in a row, two days in a row of diving. And the first day I was in excruciating pain. I couldn't get down past 30 feet. Oh, I don't know where that was. I have no idea. But then the second day, my ears did not go back to normal. They were all screwed up or whatever. And I went down, oh my God, this is beautiful. I went down this bed. I was so astounded. All of a sudden, where's all the pain? I'm going down. Okay. And then ever since then, every dive I do is still excruciating pain. I can't do it.
We never found
and
out.
And I can't pop them. I can do it right now. I can wiggle my jaw and I'll pop a little wee bit. As soon as I get under the water, a little pressure under the water, they just clam right up. Just like these headphones are on there. I can't do a thing.
Did you ever have it looked at? Did you ever go in and say, hey, doc?
I think I might have back in the early days of the flying and all that. And they just said it's just people are not good at that stuff. You know.
Anyways, if you take a jar of preserved jam from Grandma's place to your place and it involves an airplane, be aware of the fact that will probably pop the seal. And I think that's a great lesson
on how
to learn.
How heavy duty Bev put that on, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's the pressure inside the can, I'm assuming. Well, hey, listen to episode 19 of Under the Canopy, they will tell you exactly what that is all about. Now, you say you listened to it.
I was there when it was recorded, yeah.
Yeah, and so am I right?
You're right, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, if you take preserves that have been sealed up into a different stratosphere, it will pop.
And they can spoil once they're popped. So if you don't pay attention, you may it may be bad.
All of that available, great information available on Under the Canopy on the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network.
Come on,
available right now. And that's not a bunch of bullshit.
It's a bunch of bullshit.
No, it's not, Jimmy. Stop it.
Jimmy thinks this whole podcast is a bunch of bullshit. The whole network, everybody's a bunch of bullshit.
What do we got? New on Fishing Canada.
What? I wonder if Jimmy would approve of this podcast. What do you think Jimmy would think of this podcast? Because he was very opinionated. He liked to, when he wasn't happy with stuff, he especially liked to write to you and call you up on a personal level.
So. Well, they all pick me. None of them ever pick on you. Have you noticed that?
Well, they should pick on Dean.
Every once in a while, though, there used to be a few that picked on you.
Oh, yeah.
I had to console you a couple of times.
Had a couple.
That's all right.
Almost came to fisticuffs.
That's right.
You know? Anyways. You know.
New on fishing.
Can't keep them all happy, Ange.
We try. God only knows we try.
We try. We got guys like Dean and Volva to make us look good and sound good. Exactly. And still, every now and then, you get a bunch of bullshit at you, and you can't.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
And you can't, you know. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
By the way, I would like viewers that are watching, if you listen to this podcast and you watch the Fish in Canada show on Global Television Network every Saturday morning, 8 a.m., coast to coast, with the exception of BC, where it airs at 10:30.
Come on now.
If you are one of those people and are now currently, no, they wouldn't be currently. When does this episode?
This airs this week.
This week.
We're putting it right away.
All right. So
yeah.
I'm going to change the message a bit. I want you to make a note. Make a note. Get the crayon out. Make a little note on the table in front of you or wherever you happen to be. The new series, the Fish in Canada show, premieres each year, the first Saturday of January. So I believe this year that's the 8th of January. I could be. I'll stand to be corrected on that.
Yeah, that's not makes a lot. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If there's 7 days in a week,
that'd be
you might
too late,
make a second
eh?
Saturday.
Sunday. Maybe it's, no, it's maybe I don't know. Anyways, you'll know. You'll know.
You can't go count check. Too good, but you can add them up already.
Is there any place where we put that schedule out of air dates and stuff?
On the portal.
I think.
On the portal.
Yep.
The gateway to your next fishing adventure?
Yep, it's up there.
It's yep. there now?
No, it will be.
It will be. So check out the portal.
Depends on how COVID treats us too, though, you know, because if some of our editing team over there, sitting there getting picked off by COVID really bad lately.
I want to talk about that.
There might be a little bit of a delay on the premiere episode. You know,
no, we're okay. So. We brought in the lefty from the bullpen.
That's, yeah, but he's not a closer.
No, he's not. He's never been a closer.
No,
no.
But, we need good closers. Yeah, like we need our closer here is good, but we're relying on one and one only.
Yeah.
So he's like the best in the business, but.
Anyways, what I'd like you to do now that they've sidetracked me here completely, when you see that first new episode,
yes,
or the second. Or the third, I'd like you to comment on it. I'd like you to send us a quick little note and tell us what you, first of all, what you think of it and how you like the new look and feel of the Fish in Canada show.
Oh, you guys have changed it, have you?
Yeah, there's some changes.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to see if people realize it.
Okay. I like.
I don't know why I went to that. I was in the middle of something else far more.
We were under the canopy, and you went to that from under the canopy.
How is that even possible? Yeah, I don't even know.
It's a bunch of bullshit.
Well, you know what it is? You guys distract me. I get onto a train of thought, and then you guys.
But you had to get that train of thought from somewhere else because we were talking about T-40. We were talking about under the canopy preserving and blowing gaskets. And now on to our next subject, and it's not the Fish in Canada show. So somehow you have got...
I know what it was. You mentioned Volva. You were talking something about Volva.
How handsome he is?
Well, there's that too. We don't talk about that near enough, I think.
He's shaking his head over there.
But no, that's what went in my head, the new look and feel.
I got you.
So I'd like you to do that. Never mind, these guys are trying to, distract me.
Gotcha.
Let us know what you think of the
new show. Please input again. Give some feedback.
And there might be something nice in it for you. I don't know.
Ooh.
If you do that, I don't even know yet. I have no idea.
Of all the places for That's a Bunch of Bullshit, I think that was the one that...
That's a Bunch of Bullshit.
That's the one that should have been right there. Of this whole show, that's the real one right there. But anyways.
New.
On fishingcanada.com. New
on fishingcanada.com, the portal, the gateway to your next fishing adventure.
God. Oh, my God.
Winter anglers, you may not be insured. This is an interesting story that's up there now. We did talk about this a year ago about that's the right. same time.
Yeah,
is it a rehash of that same?
It's a rehash because I feel like most people still don't know. We posted it up, and a lot of people said they had no idea. So. No,
and this was our very own, our lovely, our talented Peter Bowman who brought this to our attention.
Correct, Amundo. So for those anglers that are pushing the limits, usually it is Southern Ontario in our case, and I don't know about other provinces because this is an Ontario thing for insurance. There's a lot of boat fishing going on right now still, right? Open water, those hardcore anglers that are out there that'll go beyond November 3rd. Is it 30th or 31st? What's the last day of November?
30th.
So when you go into December 1st. So I had a buddy that him and I were going to go fishing, and he said his wife, for some reason, I don't know why, she looked into the insurance, and the on-water coverage ceases at November 30th. So December 1st through to March 31st, you have zero on the water coverage. He had. So I thought, that's a bunch of bullshit right there.
That's a bunch of bullshit.
And I thought, okay, well, we're going to take my boat then. Call up my insurance company and hear the shuffling of the papers because she had no idea either. You know what I mean? Like, oh, yeah, Mr. Bowman, that's correct. You're not insured on the water from December 31st to March 1st. So I says, I could drive my boat on my trailer all over the place. That's insured 100%. You're insured up to the boat launch. As soon as that boat gets in the water, your insurance is done, null and void. And I said,
what that's all about.
Yeah. And I asked her that. I said, well, how about if I can, I top up, I pay a little bit more for the month of December or something like that. No, we can't do that. See, they don't even want more money. They just don't want to insure it. They don't want to change the policies or whatever. And so I said, is this kind of normal? And she started looking. She says, well, as far as I know, all companies are doing that. So if you do, like I'll tell you right now, the boats that I see out on the Adolphus Reach, Lake Ontario right now, there are some expensive rigs out there, $150,000, you know, dollar rigs out there. They might not be insured on the water. So if something happens, you might want to just take a look.
I find that hard to believe.
I do too.
I do too.
Now, we looked at it. They say there might be the odd company that you can get a extra, not a rider, I don't know, whatever you call it, on your policy.
Yeah.
But they said it's rare.
They insure everything.
I know.
Insurance companies are gluttons.
I offered them money.
They just want money. They want money. They insure everything.
Yeah.
Why would they not insure a man's boat, woman's boat, sorry, couple's boat, December, January, February, and March? I don't get it.
It's unreal. I couldn't figure it out either way.
I don't get it. The temperature?
But it's nothing to do with it, right? It's not going to change the boat's characteristics at all. Fiberglass or aluminum, it doesn't really change that at all.
What it does change, and maybe this is part of boat insurance, the perils are far greater.
Well, yeah, but that might be in a comprehensive more than anything, right? Or would it be? It's not like a collision thing with your boat.
No, it's a liability.
Liability thing. So, but they don't even state that. Just so your boat is not insured on the water. You know what I mean?
Somebody needs to make some sense of this. Because I don't get it.
Do we have any insurance listeners here? Anybody that's listening here that's really into the world of insurance?
Could we get hooked up with somebody?
Probably could. Like a marine insurance.
Would that be a big deal? Like, are you busy or?
I'm busy, but I can squeeze that in.
You could find the time?
I could find the time, yeah.
You could find the time to get us connected with somebody.
Sure.
It would be nice to get
a definitive answer and get it over with. Yeah. Then we know. I mean, there's a lot of people, especially I was just talking to Gordy about Pizer, and he tells me that, man, it's really bleak up there for the prospect of ice. He's saying it's...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I heard the same thing down here, too. Yeah. I mean, obviously, down here, it'd be worse than up there.
Up there, he's concerned that there will not be ice for sure. There won't be ice for Christmas, he said. So
there's still open water in Lake of the Woods?
Yeah.
Wow.
So he's saying even if it starts freezing now, it would not be safe ice by Christmas. And Christmas, apparently, that week between Christmas and New Year's, is big on Lake of the Woods, big for ice fishing.
Right, it's business.
And apparently that's when all the Americans start driving on the lake road, the frozen road.
Yeah, that's so cool, eh?
That week between December and New Year's, but he says, I can't see it being safe. There may be ice forming by that time, but I can't see it.
So the small lakes would be, because I've seen some pictures and videos already of small lakes up north that are already frozen over, but they're still walking out with their spuds like we were talking about the other day.
Of course.
You know, like that. Yeah. But yeah, that's crazy to have Lake of the Woods at this time of year. So they mean, so literally they could have boats out there right now if they if they have a launch that's open, if the snow's, you know.
Yeah, because they have open season pretty much. They don't have any closures at all.
Not, I don't think so. Not for their walleye. I mean, they might have some, but I think it'd be open right now for them. So
no bass is no closure.
How much do you think, speaking of ice fishing, I talked to a bait dealer the other day.
Did you?
What do you think, how many minnows do you think a bait dealer sells through the ice fishing season on the Bay of Quinte, Deserano?
Yeah.
What would be a bad year, what would be a good year? Number of minnows.
You want it in terms of gallons or pounds?
Minnows.
So I can give you
number.
Both.
Gallons.
Well, I don't
gallons.
Know how, who
he
would.
Buy,
who,
he
I don't
buys
know
it
who,
by the gallons.
You buy them by the gallon.
Right. But just for our audience, they don't know about gallons and minnows and all
I know, because I used to sell them.
I know you did. But just get a number of minnows. Number. What would be a number, a bad number to sell?
Oh, man.
A low, like really low.
For over what period of time?
The ice fishing season.
The whole season.
Like starting, he got his minnows in this weekend, or this last week, he got them in. And there's no ice yet.
In the millions. I mean, lots.
One bait dealer? No, not that much.
Bay of Quinte?
50,000 was his low, and he'll sell over 100,000 in that short December, January, February sort of thing. Like that.
Yeah, I used to have the number. I used to know how many minnows were in a gallon, because I bought them. 1,000?
1,000 in a gallon.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Oh.
Look at that. Hey, I got you on that one.
How'd you know that?
Because he told me.
Oh, okay.
He buys them by the gallon. It's 1,000 a gallon.
So I used to buy 5 or 6 gallons at a time.
So 5 to 6,000 minnows,
At a time. And he was in every week. He came in every week. Yeah.
But you see, you're in a different
five
area.
5 or 6,000 a week. Yeah. Okay. I mean, he's only got a 3 month window.
You got a 3 month window, tiny little shop in one spot. Obviously the Belleville people can sell more.
Yeah, that's
and
about right.
And Picton's people would sell more.
Yeah, 50 to 100,000.
Yeah, that's what he said. 100,000 would be a good year.
Yeah,
of minnows. I thought that was pretty good though.
What great business that was.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's just when he gets them, they go.
Oh.
They just go, like you said, there's a constant barrage of the guy keep bringing in gallons of minnows and gallons of minnows.
The biggest problem that you have in that industry is if you have equipment failure, which we used to do periodically.
Oh, yeah.
And you just got a load in, and then your pumps quit overnight, or your refrigeration system, one of the two quits overnight, and it's just sheet of dead.
Did you
bodies.
Sell more shiners than mud minnows?
I hated shiners.
I know, because they die easy.
I hated them. They were the most delicate thing in the world. Even when
you're fishing, anytime, shiners are horrible.
Even if your equipment is top-notch and refrigeration system is top-notch and your circulation system is top-notch, with Emerald shiners, we used to have a 20% loss right off the bat. 20% loss, meaning 20% of every a shiner that we'd bring in would die before it got a chance to be sold. Mm. Yeah. And then if you had, like I said, any minor little hiccup in the system, you were done.
Wow.
Toast. But the other stuff was great. Regular minnows,
dace, mud minnows, whatever we call them. Mud.
Yeah.
You know, the difference when you're fishing, here's a little tip for everybody. This is all organic. This is why you listen to Ange and Pete right here, because this is the deal right here. The difference between using shiner minnows.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
The difference between shiner minnows and, let's say, dace. So if you had a split shot above your bait and you have it free line and kind of swimming around like that, the shiner minnows will always swim up. They try to get away, up to the bottom, up. And the other ones always swim down. So when you're fishing for walleye, for instance, or something like that, you want them, you know, close to the weeds or something. You want that minnow is always trying to, it's always trying to work its way down to the bottom.
So
other guys are always trying to go up like that.
So the shiners are going down?
Shiners are going up.
Shiners are going up.
Shiny towards heaven.
Ah, shiners are going up and the others going down. And you know why that is?
Go ahead.
No, I'm serious.
No, I don't know why.
I know exactly why.
Okay.
Because shiners, emerald shiners in particular, I don't know what other shiner, because we used to sell emerald shiners. They are a pelagic fish, right? They school up and right. generally in over deep water, and that's where they live. So the pressure of being down low always, in my opinion, makes them want to go up into that comfort zone up higher. Whereas
suspending zone.
Whereas a regular minnow is no stranger to hanging out at the bottom. Yeah. He very seldom hangs out in open water. He hangs out near structure or under cover, but definitely near the bottom. So it's no surprise to me that if you use them on a slip rig, they will go down and shiners will come up.
There you go. Hey, that's nugget right there.
Oh, you know what that is? There's only one way you get that, by the way, just so that we make it perfectly clear.
He's got his finger on a trigger over there, by the way. Just,
there's a bunch of
just to let you know. What is that?
Experience.
That's experience.
That's
right
all that is. It's experience.
That's exactly.
And doesn't hurt to know a little bit about the creature. And that, you know, we've made our entire career based on knowledge, right? That's all we do. If nothing else, we have amassed a vast amount of knowledge by trial and error. And that's what we do on the Fishing Canada Show every week. We take that experience and try and parlay it into a fishing adventure. So I couldn't do that if I was not that there's anything wrong with 20-year-olds. I'm just telling you, I couldn't do that if I was 20 years old, like grandson Nick, right?
Oh, good point.
So he's
I'm living with an 18 and a 20-year-old boy too. I know.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
I know Zachary. What you're doing? Yeah,
solid.
Cement.
Solid.
There's cement no room. In that head.
See, the problem is there's no room. You can't absorb anything when you're.
True.
So it's impossible.
So we have a hollowness in our heads. Is that what you're saying?
Through the years, it comes with age. You tend to
the brain settles, more, and there's a little room on the top.
Exactly.
There. Okay. Exactly. I get that.
There's an adventure just outside these walls.
It's something you'll hate to leave, and can't wait to get back to.
It's a place where memories are made and bonds are forged.
For some, it's hitting the trails. For others, it's a weekend at the lake. It's a place full of campfires and quality time.
This year, take some time to reconnect with friends, family, and nature. No matter what adventures await you, Coleman has the gear you need. Visit ColemanCanada.ca to gear up today.
The outside is calling.
Answer the call.
As the world gets louder and louder, the lessons of our natural world become harder and harder to hear, but they are still available to those who know where to listen. I'm Jerry Ouellette, and I was honored to serve as Ontario's Minister of Natural Resources. However, my journey into the woods didn't come from politics. Rather, it came from my time in the bush and a mushroom. In 2015, I was introduced to the birch-hungry fungus known as chaga, a tree conch, with centuries of medicinal use by indigenous peoples all over the globe. After nearly a decade of harvest, use, testimonials, and research, my skepticism has faded to obsession, and I now spend my life dedicated to improving the lives of others through natural means. But that's not what the show's about. My pursuit of this strange mushroom and my passion for the outdoors has brought me to the places and around the people that are shaped by our natural world. On Outdoor Journal Radio's Under the Canopy podcast, I'm going to take you along with me to see the places, meet the people that will help you find your outdoor passion and help you live a life close to nature and under the canopy. Find Under the Canopy now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Where were we?
Fan question.
Mandy from Ontario via email submits a wonderful fan question this
week. Great question.
And how do people do that? Like, how do they submit these things, Dean?
These are all email. I take them off Instagram occasionally, but most of these are from email.
All right. So if you want to ask us something, all you have to do is just write it in. Email.
Yeah.
Info@fishingcanada.com. You can send it to any of our emails?
Sure.
Those aren't public.
Our emails aren't public?
Yeah, don't send them to ours then.
Really?
No.
Well, the thing about info is very good.
So if I was guessing, if I was one of them and I was guessing on how to get a hold of, let's say, you.
Yeah.
I would think, because I know that there's a fishingcanada.com, that means that there is a URL there already. So I would assume that fishingcanada.com. Oh, and I know that there's info at fishingcanada.com.
Yep.
If I was looking for you, for example, I wanted to send something directly to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm guessing.
That handsome bastard at fishingcanada.com is what I would do for Dean.
That would be your first
try. That would be my first try.
That would get me.
And that would get right to him probably.
I would just go for the short. I'd go Dean at fishingcanada.com. That's me. That's what I would do. But anyways, however you do it, it's irrelevant. You know how to reach us. Reach us. Send us your fan question just like Mandy did. Mandy from Ontario. Okay. She wants to know, Mandy wants to know, how do you feel about the parking situation around Lake Simcoe, putting locals up against visitors? If you're not aware what started happening a couple of years ago, it started out with boat launching, became ridiculously expensive at the municipal, there's only one municipal area parking lot with a launch ramp, and that's at the Athersley Narrows between Lake Simcoe and Cooch at the top end of Lake Simcoe. That's where everybody used to put in, and it was always free. Forever, it was free. We used to use it all the time, and there were tournament events there that had access to it all the time. Anyway, some brilliant entrepreneur at the municipal council meetings decided, you know, we need to start charging for that. And that's really where this reared its ugly head originally. And I don't remember the year, but it would have been, a good 15 years ago, maybe even 20 years ago. They started charging for boaters, which maybe makes sense. You have to maintain the launch ramp, you know, every year you have to spruce it up and do some stuff. I'm sure there was vandalism involved and all that stuff. But anyways, they said they should start charging $10, I think it was at the time. Anyways, from that day, things started progressing pretty quick because I said some entrepreneur, it became a business for the municipality to the point where they started charging for parking. So not only do you have to pay for the boat to be launched, but you had to also pay to park your vehicle with the trailer on it because the boat lives on a trailer.
Hell yeah.
And that became a nightmare. And it started out as $10 and then went to $20 and then got completely out of hand and is now sitting at $50. So if you want to go boating on Lake Simcoe or Cooch or in the town of Orillia, right? She's a $70 hit just to start with.
And what we've been hearing lately is that they were using COVID as an excuse to keep people away.
Right.
Well, we know that's a bunch of bullshit for sure.
It's a bunch of bullshit.
And if that's the case, then when COVID is finally over, let's say it's not over yet, then those prices should go back down to $20 a day, right? Well, you know that ain't going to happen. That's just not going to happen.
Oh, no. Right? Once you establish, you don't go down.
Once they've established, they're not.
You go up.
Exactly. You don't go down. Exactly. Right. So we wrote down some.
Anyway,
I got a few of the places, though, Ann.
Let me just finish with her thing, and then we'll get into that, right? So she says some areas are charging $50 per day to park. Want to bring people in to spend money, but charges an arm and a leg to fish for the day. So they want, tourism wants people to go to these places.
Mm-hmm.
And so people go. But that's why tourism wants them to go, to spend money.
Yeah, you get gouged there doing that.
To
obviously
spend money, so it's a catch-22, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Anyways, just we totally get you, Mandy. And this was pre-COVID too. They're using COVID now. But no. Ann's, like Ann said,
it started.
Steve and I, when we did that little bass thing up in Innisfil, it was the same thing. We thought, what the hell? The launching was free there, but the parking was $45 way back then. It's like $45 for a boat and a trailer. A car, a single car without a trailer, I think it was $10 for the day or something like that. What they're doing is they're gouging the anglers. They're coming in here with your trailer.
Well, no, anybody with a boat.
Anybody with a boat, any boaters. And all that. So Innisfil, it's $10 an hour for a maximum up to $50 for parking alone.
Wow.
Not your boat launches. Wow. There's another one there. The cheapest one we could find is $7 an hour up to $45. That's the cheapest one you could find in that area.
Well, you know, everybody's going to max out. Who puts their boat in for an hour?
Exactly. Everybody maxes out. Wow. Barrie is the same thing. $10 an hour, the max of $50. And it's a $10 plus HST boat launch. You got to pay the HST on the boat too on top of that. So they're like Ann says, there's a $60 a day, $75, whatever it is. $60 a day just to start, just to get in the water.
And don't get this wrong, okay? We're not idiots here. We know that there are costs to maintain these wonderful places.
That boat launch that's $10 for us is free to Barrie residents. It's just for us guys. So Barrie, the locals, if you have a little thing in your...
So the locals are okay.
You're okay, but we have to pay.
But the tourist has to pay for the upkeep.
Yeah.
Well, see, I don't...
Because the locals are paying for it through taxes, I guess they figure, right?
Why. See, now that makes sense. The locals pay taxes already. Some of that money goes to the upkeep of these municipal properties, like a parking lot and a launch ramp. And the people who come in from outside of that community don't pay those taxes there. And therefore, they feel that they should be paying a portion of that too.
Taxes on our boat launches in our area. Do they come down and pay the extra on that? No, they don't. We, you know, that's not even.
Well, the launch ramp here at Port Perry,
correct.
The ramp itself is free to launch your boat, but to park your boat,
like $10 or $20 or whatever.
So I think it's $20 for the day.
Yeah.
Full day.
Yeah.
I think is reasonable.
That's fine. That's reasonable.
Somebody's got to pay for the maintenance.
It's like if you're going to a marina, you're going to pay for a boat launch and parking at a marina. That's fine. You know, you're paying for that facility. But to gouge you at $60 a day, you know, $50 to $75 a day.
That might be a little over the top.
That is it's brutal.
If anybody is listening to this that is from that municipality, Aurelia.
Anywhere in that. It seems like it's all on the west side of Lake Simcoe. So Innisfil, Barrie, Aurelia, all that whole side there.
Once one starts, the other ones have to join in,
I don't know
right?
about, Beaverton. I don't know if we ever, what they're like. They used to be great. There used to be a small fee for that. Remember
what
we used to go there?
Fee?
It wasn't much. It wasn't bad, and it was just the launch.
That was at the marina, launch. Though. You paid at
that
the
little
marina.
At the end of the river.
Yeah.
It was kind of a marina, yeah. And then you put that little tiny little boat launch, but you drop her in there, and you could either park in the lot until it was full, and then you could park along the road.
Right.
You paid us, I think it was $20, or it wasn't much back then.
See, $20 is, I think, is a good price.
Oh, that's great!
Right
it's
across the board
it.
For everybody, locals, tourists.
Absolutely.
If you've got an occasion that requires a boat launch and a parking lot.
Hell,
that has to be
cheap.
Maintained. $20 is fair.
It's very fair.
Yeah,
absolutely. Anywhere. So
there you go.
It's also starting to get bad now. Like the ice season's horrible up there for it, and that's why a lot of people park on the ice way too early. You see a lot
that
of happened. Cars go through because you don't have to pay.
Well, that happened last year. I remember doing a podcast during this period, or just a little bit later on last year, where people were cars were going through the ice and the reason that the drivers were saying they were parking on the ice because it was $50 to park on shore.
Yeah.
Right.
So once the ice started forming, they just said, to hell with it. I'm going to park out on the... Now, so that one is interesting because in terms of maintenance, there's winter maintenance too. Yeah, they have to snow plow the parking lot and stuff. Somebody's got to pay for it.
Are apparently locals now along Lake Simcoe that are actually allowing people to park on their property and charging them a lot less. Yeah, you know what, buddy? They're gouging you. I'll do it for a third of the price. You know, $10. Give me $10 to park your car. Something
nice
like that.
Little enterprise.
Absolutely, cash money and piss on the rest of them. I don't mind that at all. So if you maybe find you hear about that, you look into that, folks. If you can find somebody,
but somebody has to pay for the maintenance on all of these properties. It's just how much is the question.
Exactly. Like how much, I mean, when you're, it's like you said, it's a trend over there. This is obviously an ongoing trend over there that if they can do it, if Innisfil can do it, I'm going to do it in Barrie. Hey, if Barrie can do it in Aurelia, I can do it in Aurelia. You know what I mean? They're all playing that same game.
Okay. But now I was just thinking about something. everything is increased in price. Everything is more expensive today than it was, say, 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago.
Sure.
I don't care what it is. Food.
Absolutely.
Gasoline. And those two commodities automatically increase prices and everything associated with those items. So why would we not expect the price of, say, winter maintenance, which is snow plowing of these parking lots, to be more expensive today than it was 5-6 years ago?
Yeah, of course. But so, to go to a ridiculous amount?
But we just said $20 is okay. Why? Because, you know, 10 years ago, $20 is acceptable.
10 years ago, it was $10. They've gone up to $20 now.
I see. So you're saying the jump was a little too much.
The jump was way too much. So let's be honest.
What would be fair? Assuming that $20 is not enough now, because when they jumped to $20.
Clearly that wasn't enough for all these municipalities. They need a lot more than that, don't they? I would say...
What's a good price? What do you think?
At most, let's say $10 launch and $20. So $30 a max with everything. That might be in a city area or something like that. That might be acceptable. Even that's kind of hard to suck in. But let's just say it was, you know, I don't know. What do you think? Because it's going to go to $75 very soon.
Okay, here's
right?
what I think. I think it has to be proportionate. So I can tell you with total certainty that the boat and the vehicle that I used to drive to Orillia and put in at the Orillia launch ramp 7-8 years ago, that package, the total package, was $100,000.
Yeah.
That same total package today is over $200,000.
And the guy that was there with his 12-foot tenor that's 15 years old.
Same thing.
That boat. $68.
If he bought it a decade ago, that same boat today is worth $35,000.
There's boats out there. Everybody has
what I'm saying is you have to be realistic.
Right.
Right? If this cost that much 10 years ago and now it costs this much, well, everything else has to be increased proportionate.
I'm talking about that guy that's had to upkeep his little 12, 14 footer. It's an old boat. It still floats well. He can't afford shit. He barely can afford the gas to go in it. Now he's got to pay $50 to $60 to launch that little wee tiny boat that's not worth $300. That poor guy. He's driving his little shit box vehicle. That poor guy. Angelo, I can't do this. I can't. You and your $100,000 rig, you can afford to buy the boat launch.
You know, there's always going to be that argument. Anyways, now, do you see what you went and done, Mandy?
That's a great question, Mandy. Thank you for that, because it needs to be investigated. There's something going on here. Like, when is it going to stop? Is it going to stop, and when?
Unfortunately, no.
Well, not when COVID's over. No, it's not. No, it ain't, people.
So. Speaking of COVID, you said earlier on, you know, that there's been
run rampant through the system.
There's been a bunch of COVID around here. I had it, and I can tell you personally, it's not the same as it was last year. So if we are going to be inundated with COVID again this year,
put your boxing gloves on, because you're in for a fight by the sounds of it with you and Monique.
Wow.
Had. Wow.
And everybody I've talked to that's had it, and a lot of folks, as I told you, have had it, it's the same story. This one is a tough one.
Wow.
It's going to be around. You know, the last time, it was like a 3-4 day, 5 day max, you were back to 100%.
Yeah.
This one is a bad one.
Well, the only time that you've ever taken that much time off was your heart attack.
Exactly.
That's it.
Exactly.
Other than that, you've never taken that much time off.
Exactly.
So off work.
I just spoke to Jack this morning, Uncle Jack, and his wife got it.
Oh, God.
And she's been 3 weeks and still not back.
Holy crap.
Yeah, oh, it's a killer. Just keep an eye out on it. I mean, there's nothing you can do. We're not going to go back to isolation. We're not going to go back, in some cases, we're not even going back to wearing masks. So what we need to do, we need to be a little more vigilant ourselves. One thing.
You don't think we'll go back to masks?
No.
No?
I don't think you're going to see that, not unless it's government ordered.
I think I just heard that the haircut places might be having to be ordered into it.
Well, that would be a place where you're in such close proximity, right?
Yeah, I just heard that the other day, so I don't know if that's gone through yet or not, but.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised on that one, that the companies themselves are mandating their employees to wear masks.
And you know what? When you're going in there for a haircut, why not wear a mask just in case, just for yourself, because you're that close? I mean, even if they're wearing a mask.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway.
I don't know where how we got to that, but
COVID. Boat launching and COVID.
Okay, speaking of boat launching, today's topic, we never even told you what we were going to talk about today.
Well,
and here we are.
Lost them already, here, didn't we?
Who'd we lose?
We probably lost them. They were probably waiting for a subject, and they probably said, oh, my God, all they're doing is talking again, not telling us what the real subject is. I hope not. I hope they're with us because they like us and love us and want us and desire us and need us.
I don't know why we selected this topic. Well, first of all, let me bring this full circle. We didn't select this topic. This topic was ordered.
Come on now.
On us. And it is a fall and open water walleye fishing. I guess maybe the reason is because we're in fall.
It's on right now.
Open water winter fishing is probably going to be going on for a while. What's going to happen if places like, the bay, we know that people will fish it while they still can with their boats. And then when it freezes, obviously there's mass migration of ice fishermen.
Absolutely.
Out on the water.
Yeah.
I wonder if some of these small outlying lakes, though, that have ice fishing but won't have ice, assuming that their boats are insured, we just put a kibosh on that one when we told you that your boat may not be insured.
Exactly.
What are they going to do?
Well, do you really think the inland lakes aren't going to freeze? Like a little bit, like a lot of people, like maybe Scugog, it's not that very far north. It's a warm water lake. Well, it's not warm now. This time of year is still in the 30s probably. But do you think if you went an hour north, they won't freeze this whole winter?
I'm just saying.
I don't even know if it's ever happened before.
We've had seasons where it froze late.
Right.
But it did freeze by January.
Yeah.
This would not be the first December without
For sure. I don't know. Well, yeah, people will be – ice anglers are going to be very disappointed, that's for sure, if they don't get their ice, right?
Purveyors of ice ice fishing opportunities like the huts and
– the Lake Simcoe guys, the Callander Bay and all those. Yeah, those they make a lot of money or a lot of business on that, right? They depend on that. So I hope it freezes over. Guys like Dean. Dean loves ice fishing. So,
I do. You know, I like it more than open water.
Yeah.
I wait all year.
Why is that? Why?
I think I'm better equipped because I can't afford a $100,000 boat and everything, but
you're
I can afford
that $38 tenor I was talking about, right? Yeah.
But I have like the top of the end hut for like $1,200. I have live scope. That's like my top investment.
Right.
The auger, it's not too expensive, so you can get like all decked out for way cheaper.
True.
Everything's more accessible. You just have to walk or snowmobile there. So.
Oh, you can afford a snowmobile.
Yeah.
That's not a problem.
I bought one last year and the trail's never open, so it's unused.
But there you go. So you choose to invest in winter equipment as opposed to, because I'm sure the price of that snowmobile would have bought you a handsome little boat package.
No, this thing is barely staying alive. It was about $1,000.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a bunch of bullshit. That's all I got to say.
It's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are some. There are anglers out there that like ice fishing better than open water.
There are anglers that only ice fish.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't even
That's
bother.
That's all they do.
Don't even bother with it.
So it's a big deal. So, anyways, so we thought we would talk a little bit about Canada's number one favorite walleye fishing for sure, is by far the most. Pursued.
So, eh?
Oh, yeah.
I think
it's
so.
It's huge. It's pursued by more people in this country than any other species. It used to be lake trout years ago.
Really? Lake trout and wall fish,
yeah,
eh?
I know. Well, because the rural parts of the country, right? That's all they have is lake trout. They don't have walleye. Walleye is pretty much
lakes,
a southern commodity, although it's moved up north now, obviously, with a vengeance. But lake trout was number one everywhere.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's a great stat right there.
Yeah.
I learned something new today. I like that.
Every day. A man should learn something every day, in my opinion. And if you listen to this program, that could happen.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
Well, there's that too.
I'm looking at that box of Timbits right now, learning and trying to learn to see if there's anything in that.
Yeah.
But it's over on Nick's desk, and the COVID kid might have his hands all over it, so I ain't going anywhere near it. So he's probably saying there, go ahead, boys.
It's funny. I looked at that a couple of times and just thought the same thing. So location, location, location. Walleye, probably more so than any other species, there's more difficulty in determining where walleye are going to be at any given time in the season on most bodies of water than I think any other species. Bass, to a certain degree, but they're pretty easy to figure out. But mm-hmm. walleye,
you're right.
Walleye
you're
right. is not.
You're right.
There's so many factors that go into determining where the most effective place to fish walleye would be on any body of water. So we want to start today with what we perceive to be the most important piece of information that's required for good, solid walleye fishing. And that is where you have to find out where they at some point in the season, where they start. Right. Once you get that and you drill down into that, their movements are pretty predictable. And it'll help you tremendously in finding out where they're going to be later in the year. And spawning is that time of year where you can pretty much guarantee on any body of water where the primary and secondary and usually two main areas where walleye are going to spawn.
Correct. Correct. Amundo.
Right? And once you get that under your belt, the rest kind of unfolds easily, and we'll go through that here.
Yeah, yeah. Because the spawn right now, as Ange and I have always said, all fish, all they think about is eating and spawning.
That's it.
That's all they have in their life. That's all they ever care about, right? And the spawning is not because they want to do it. It's because it's just driven in as to what they do. It's what we all do, you know. It's procreate to keep your species going. So you got to think that spawning thing, especially right now. In this, you know, right now we're talking in early December, can be even late November, and it goes right through till up and under the ice, once the ice goes, and then until the ice leaves. So that water temperature starts hitting in the 40s, you know what I mean? Right now the water, believe it or not, on Lake Ontario, we'll call it, is in the 30s already. It's now, it dropped, in 2 weeks, Ange, it dropped from 45 to 33.
So there
in that
you go.
Short of time. In that short of time, there's no ice, nothing like just the short days, the cool nights, the cold nights like that. It's dropped that much in that. And these fish are all, they're all now being triggered by that. Hey, where are we going to go now? And you got to remember on lakes like Lake Ontario, the main species that we always hear about are these pelagic fish, as Ange mentioned earlier, these ones that roam a lot. They don't sit on one structure. They are open water kind of oriented. They're not open water all the time, but they're very oriented.
At some point,
they're definitely going to be open water. That's something we should explain too. When we talk about open water walleye, it's not that they're just out in the open. Usually these are the ones that are suspended, and they're sitting halfway down, a third of the way down, two-thirds of the way down, in deep water, let's just say, something like that. These fish they're not sitting on structure their whole life. They're not sitting on a rock pile. They're not sitting on a point. They're not sitting in a weed bed their whole life. It's almost like two different types of walleye that are out there, right? But these open water, that's what that open water walleye means. They're just sort of sitting out there in the middle of nowhere.
I think where the uniqueness of that happens more so than anywhere else is on the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
Lake Ontario in particular.
Lake Ontario's got
where you have a group of fish that live pretty much their whole life in open water, and then they'll come in late in the year. This is about the time when they start migrating to their spawning areas, and they
still in open water.
Still in open water.
They're doing it. Yeah.
They'll start moving into their spawning areas, getting closer to their spawning areas by going up to the rivers, and in this case the Bay of Quinte. The fish will come in from Lake Ontario and start moving into the bay and up through Adolphus Reach, and their goal is to get to their primary spawning area.
The biggest ones would be the Trent River
would be number
one. The Moira
one.
River and the Napanee River. Those are the three biggies that they're trying to get to.
And those fish would be considered open water fish. However, there is another gene pool there of fish that do not travel to open water, being Lake Ontario, and then come in
correct
for spawning purposes. This genetic pool lives their entire life from the beginning, from the early stages of the river all the way up. And that's where they live. And those are the fish that would relate more to things that we understand, rock piles, weed lines. They'll still be in, they don't mind traveling to deep water, but deep water to them is just moving offshore.
Right.
Not out into Lake Ontario.
30 feet, something like that.
And I think that's a pretty unique situation. I don't think we can say that that happens for the most part in inland lakes.
I don't know. Almost my mind is now separating two groups of walleye and every body of water I go to, because I'm seeing more open water walleye in these smaller lakes, and then I'm seeing more, and you still got your traditional walleye and your.
So you think, let's take Nipissing.
Okay, that'd be probably
a good example, right? Mm-hmm. So you think that in Nipissing, Lake Nipissing, we have a group of fish that live in the basin of Lake Nipissing that just wander around feeding on bait that's high up in the water column, and they're just floating around eating on those. Those walleye never go inland, they never go down the French River, or they never, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They live out there 12 months a year. And then there's another group of walleye on Nipissing that will move into the French River at some point in their life and stay there for their entire existence. And they'll just move into deep water within the French River itself.
Right.
So you think that there are two distinct genetically different fish?
Yeah, I don't know anything about Lake Nipissing itself as the main body of water as per bait. Are there Cisco or their alewife or anything like that there? I know there's whitefish in the river. Or depends on the perch population as well, because perch is a huge prey fish for walleye. I'm learning more and more about all these little lakes that are, as long as there's some depth to it and some good open water out there, that these big walleye, they just say, you know what, I'm not a structure fish. Like those fish that Stevie goes after all the time at the mouth of the French on those little humps and all that stuff, those are probably there every year, right? They go after the same fish every year. Who's to say they're not out there roaming around a big group or 10 big groups of walleye are not out there roaming around as long as there's bait out in the middle of the lake? If there's bait on that lake, I guarantee you there's walleye cruising around. And I'll guarantee you another thing, there's a couple of guys, there's probably some guys that are keeping it hush-hush that are running planer boards all year long out there and catching probably giants on Nipissing. I'll bet you there is.
The end of the day, what's going to determine that, and I referred to them as genetically different fish, probably should not be referring to them as that. I think the key to all that is food.
Right.
So long as these big schools of fish that live in the main body of Lake Nipissing have food, they will stay there.
There's no reason to leave, right?
There's no reason to leave.
Right.
Right. But if that food becomes scarce, they may develop a whole new habit and pattern. Fish, you know, I don't know how long we've said this. I'm probably as guilty as the next person, is that fish don't have the ability to think. And I think that's a misnomer, complete misnomer in the way we perceive fish. I think they're more than capable of thinking, and I think they can think even much quicker than we think in some cases, because they are so driven by instinct to feed and reproduce. And the only thing that affects both of those is food.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the food is not available, that fish is quickly reevaluating everything in its life.
Absolutely.
And it says, hey, this has been 2-3 days now. There's no food here. I got to get out of here.
Absolutely.
Right? So yeah. They do think. They have the ability to, I won't call it reason because that would be too much, but they have the ability to change based on their environment a lot quicker than we think.
Yeah. Right. They have to. They have to survive, right? Yeah. They will do whatever it takes to eat a meal. Yeah. And I know Lake Erie does the same thing as going on with us right now. Lake Erie also, there's guys that are right now that are getting them on structure.
Yep.
They're running jigs. They're running even crankbaits down low. There's also the portion of the team that is out there running crankbaits, pulling crankbaits, and doing the same thing and getting lots of big fish right now. And I know you could do it on Lake Huron. I know you. I don't know.
Any of the
Superior, probably Superior.
Superior, sure.
Yeah, sure you could.
Yeah.
Georgian Bay, guarantee you're going to get a bunch of open water as well as structure oriented. The thing about the structure oriented, I find lately, I don't know what it is, about trying to find walleye on structure at this time of year. So when the water temperatures are really starting to dip down, they seem to be, even the ones that we're talking about, those local fish, we'll call them, they're always moving.
Yeah.
They're here one day and they're gone. And they're gone. And then maybe, and you even hear that under the ice. You'll hear, hey, you're getting them off of Huff's Point. Everybody's getting them off Huff's Point. Oh, no, now they're getting them out towards the Napanee River. Oh, they're off of Forester's Island. And they're way back now at Thompson's Point, like that. Like you're hearing with these groups of fish that are, and they're not even the giants, not even those 10-pounders, two and three pounders.
The local fish.
Yeah.
Right? And what's driving that?
That's got to be bait.
It's food.
They're moving
Everything
around.
Everything is food they're related. Looking for food. There's only one reason that a fish will hang out somewhere. Only one. And that is that.
Yeah.
There's food available somewhere within close vicinity.
It doesn't have to be structured. There's food for the. That's our latest. That's Mikey. Look at Mikey caught.
Oh my God!
That's a Cisco.
Nice.
So you want to talk about food base? I didn't know how much was in the Bay of Quinte.
Wow.
But this was caught on Saturday, and that's a giant one.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know how many walleye would eat that friggin' thing.
Those big 10-12 pounders.
Yeah, they probably take a chomp at it, right? You know what I mean? But that's probably a big one of that species. Can you imagine if there's those usual Cisco way more than we're ever thinking?
There's gotta be, right?
Yeah. I mean, I really didn't know. The Bay of Quinte is a phenomenon. It's just who knows what else is in there,
it's
right?
It's unique.
But imagine like there's lots of pike in that area. Imagine for pike swimming around seeing that. They're going to eat that thing 9 times out of 10. They're going to take a shot at that and swallow it right down. It's a soft finned fish. Like if people notice that there's no spiny dorsal on those things. The only sharp thing on that fish basically is just the edge of that gill plate, and that's not even sharp.
That is, yeah.
Yeah, right, but that'd be it. Otherwise, that's just a soft morsel of fish like that. And if there's more of those in there than we believe, can you imagine that's just another. And then you look at that, you say, hey, maybe I should be running silver baits. Maybe I should be running more silver-sided baits with a black back. You know what I mean? So aside from...
What was that one caught on?
On a jig and a minnow.
I've got it marked. I want to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. That was in 50 feet of water.
Wow.
That's 50 feet. I don't know if we got it suspended or not, but it was in 50 feet of water, that thing. So
that's good food, man.
Oh, my God.
For fish, that's... That's ideal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For sure.
For those, people are listening, they might not see that. That was a Cisco or a lake herring, what they're called. It's just a prime bait fish that if you have a lake with Cisco or lake herring in it, Hasty Lake, for instance, lakes like that, the game fish will be eating those no matter what.
So getting back to basics, and I think I'd like to pull Bay of Quinte out of this because, as I said, it's a unique fishery. Because it does have two distinct a gene of walleye in it. So it's hard to talk about one and say the other's doing the same because we know it's not. Mm-hmm. So taking Bay of Quinte out of the equation, and we also know Bay of Quinte, that there's definitely a migration pattern from open water to river that anglers can intercept the migration. The only thing, you have to be there at the right time, right? It's not
right.
It's not a question of the right place. It's more the right time. And generally, the boats that are out there will dictate where that spot exactly is. So I want to rule that out for a minute. But on a body of water where you don't have, and this is in particular to folks who fish primarily through the ice, before you could determine if it's a brand new body of water, before you can determine where you're going to drill the hole, you've got to know a little bit about something of that lake. And that is, where are these fish going to be spawning? We're talking walleye. Where is the primary spawning area for walleye on that lake? You have to. I don't care what you think of that comment. You have to know before you start putting the puzzle together, you have to know where the majority of these fish are going to be spawning on that lake. Once you isolate that and isolate it with confidence, now you can start building, you got the blocks to start building that roadway to where they're going to be before you start drilling that hole, or have a pretty good general idea of where they're going to be before you start drilling that hole. Food is still going to dictate. At the end of the day, food is going to dictate where they're going to be that particular moment, that day, that hour that you happen to be there. But you have to have the general vicinity.
So you're looking for rivers more than anything? Are you thinking
fast-moving water? Now, there are lakes where walleye have been known to spawn on a shoal. Of course, we know, right?
Of course, they spawn on shorelines all the time.
All the time, but right? but they're not primary and they're scattered. You cannot use that in most cases. You can't use it as the first piece of your puzzle because it's just too varied.
Right.
So you need things like the Thames River on Lake Simcoe, for example. You know that's where they spawn. That is the primary spawning area for every walleye on that lake. So that's where you start. If I'm winter fishing, I'm going to start there and then follow the shorelines, follow the contours on your maps, look for those points that are heading down into the deeper parts of the lake and all that stuff that we've talked about for years before you start drilling a single hole.
Good point. And I'll tell you something, Nell. The contours in your map, it's something that I've gotten away from. Since I've got paper maps out of my hands and got better mapping in my hands, I'm using it less.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
I'm getting back to using the mapping more because it's so crucial to have, you know, and now everybody's got, if you have a, like Dean said, he's got his live scope on the wall, where I'll guarantee you Dean's got a GPS in there too, and he's got a map on there, and you got good mapping on almost every unit you buy out there now, right nowadays. You can take advantage of that on the ice or off the ice in the boat, and I don't do enough of it now. We used to, that's all we live for.
And I'll tell you what I miss from maps. Exactly what we're talking about right now is finding that primary spawning area. When you've got the ability to lay out a map on a table, a nice big chart, you can see you've got a really good overview of the whole area. And you can start slowly eliminating water until you get to that primary. And the map will tell you generally, the map will tell you where that primary spawning area is. But what's nice about having it on a big map is that you can eliminate. Whereas on charts, on your chart recorder, no matter how big a screen you've got, if you blow it up to the point where you can see the entire lake, it's so tiny that you can't really determine a whole lot from it. Whereas on a big map, you just spread that baby out. We used to do it on the kitchen table. It was great. Just get rid of everything. And we used to put two and three maps together. So we had like literally a 6 foot by 8 foot area that was all map of the body of water that we were going to go fish.
Right.
And you eliminate until you've got that primary area. That is a little more difficult today using GPS chart maps like this, because it is a much smaller, but then again, I can give you that same argument for viewing a movie on a phone versus viewing a movie on my 80-inch screen.
Yeah. The one thing I like about the charts nowadays is the contour lines. We never had that before. So Ange and I'd have to literally look and say, that's the 10 foot. That was a very difficult thing to do. The contour lines now. And if you have a map, this is a Navionics web app, but the maps on your units. The one thing, even if you have a 7-inch screen, what Ange is saying, just use your zoom feature. So zoom out. So it gives a little, because then all of a sudden your contour lines get tighter and tighter and they get really dark. They get black. And now you can actually see the contour lines like that. Then when you see something far away like that, you know, it's only going to be a little section. You have to scroll over. But the whole idea is to zoom out, see these contour lines. The darker the line is, the tighter the lines are together, the faster the drop. And then you start zooming in and say, okay, there's a little dark spot there. You zoom in, pull it over, okay, there. So that's the way you kind of have to do it nowadays versus what we were talking about, having the big map on your, you can't have that big map on your table unless you got an 82-inch screen. Yeah, unless you have that screen on your boat right there, you know.
Getting back to what we were talking about, that primary spawning area, the nice thing about seeing it on a big map, the main thing you're looking for is incoming water. I mean, that's not a secret. That's the fact, is if you have a good source of incoming water, it will probably be the primary spawning. If a lake, for example, if a small lake has one source of incoming water, well, I can tell you pretty much any respectable walleye in that body of water will be keying in on that incoming water to find a suitable place to reproduce. Whether it's at the mouth, whether it's upriver, whatever the case may be, they're going to use that incoming water to spawn. So that becomes real easy. If there's only one source on that lake. That's it, man. Start there. And now the puzzle, the first piece of the puzzle is very clear. From that point, you just start working out. Pete just mentioned contour lines are so important because you want to basically build a roadway that these fish are going to use from spawning to the deepest part of the lake and back again. Somewhere along that highway that you create on a map, you are going to be sitting on a sheet of ice with a hole and finding, intercepting walleye. Not, maybe not that minute when you drill the hole, but at some point, if you've done your homework properly, you know that that highway has to be traveled by walleye at some point. And that's the key to that. And if a lake's got a multitude of incoming rivers and creeks and streams, then you have, by having a big paper map to start with, you can quickly start eliminating the smaller ones. And you can see them on a map, right? If you've got a big flowing stream of water coming into a lake.
You can see them on these too.
You can see them pretty good here, but you got to move it around.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Move it around, exactly.
You got to move it around. That's, I mean, this is, listen, this is our life. This type of
we mapping. Don't use paper maps anymore.
No.
We just don't even look at them.
I'm just saying, if you had your druthers, what you should do if you're on a new body of water that you're not familiar with and you need to find the primary spawning area, if you had a paper map, it could shorten the period of time that you'll need to find out where it is. Versus just
yeah,
going
I see what you're
here,
saying. Yeah,
right?
You see, there's that, and then you can go on this thing and scroll
now
over.
You go
now
here,
I know where Thompson's Point. There it is. There,
exactly.
And then, yeah. So I got you.
And it's a key. I don't care what body of water you're fishing. If you don't know where they start out in the spring, it's going to be hard for you to figure out where they're going to be in the winter. Plain and simple.
I know you said something there that got me, and I know it gets Dean as well. As you said, it might not bite at that minute because walleye are the worst for that. Like they'll be you go all day long. If you get sometimes even there early in the morning and they won't bite, and then all of a sudden, as soon as that sun hits the tree line at 3:30 or 4 o'clock at night, all of a sudden, boom, 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 all the lines start going off. It's firing. It's like, come on, really? I wasted all this time of this day. You're here. You're there. You're there. You know. But they're just. They're. I don't know what it is. It's so. They're such a nasty fish for that.
Food.
Well,
it's not, food.
It's food, but the food, even if the food is there, you sometimes see the perch around. You see everything like that. They just. There's something that triggers them at that. I don't know. Hey, Dean, you noticed that?
Oh, yeah.
You've seen that so many times.
That's
probably
why it's hard to move. Like when you're out on the ice, it's like hard to decide when to move because you know how quickly it can just turn.
Once it happens,
it's just
like, boom, it's on.
Think of this, though. Mm. Think of this. If you had the ability to really dial it down, like really dial this down, like some people do, by the way, mm-hmm. to know what triggers them to move, and you know that at 10 o'clock, you want to be on hole A.
Yeah.
Because more than likely, there's going to be more biting fish on hole A than there will any place else. Mm. But you also know that it's short-lived.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh,
hole
yeah.
A is going to last an hour, maybe on a good day.
Yeah.
So then hole B, because it's a migration.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you could figure it out, if you could dial that down, as some people do, man, your fishing day is just full of fish. They don't disappear.
I know, but
they don't disappear.
You see them on your screen half the time. You see them moving on your screen half the time, and they won't bite. Like sometimes, lots of if they're walleye. I mean, it might not be walleye,
well, there
but
is
there's
that too.
But like Dean had a great example last year or 2 years ago, whatever he showed.
Yeah, there's a video on the website actually of that. It was like a highway on Quinny. It was like the walleye bite just turned off. It was like 10 a.m. and the fish were still there, but they were cruising and would just not eat until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then it all started again. Like the same fish, like they were still there. I was on them all day.
Insane.
And they just stopped eating completely.
And that, again, that's what I said, even in the late fall, this time of year, right into the ice, these fish are moving way more than people think. They are constantly swimming around. A lot of times they lock on the bottom and you can't even see it. Like they'll swim all on the bottom and you can't even tell that they're moving on the bottom. That's the hardest ones, when they're just inching along the bottom. Like, and I think the majority of fish are doing that. The odd ones are up high and you can see the four or five here in a little group and all that. But I think there's so many that sit on that bottom and just move. And I don't know. Sometimes I just don't think they bite a lot of times. I don't know why. drop a jig and minnow down in front of that guy's nose, and he's not eating.
He's not eating.
Good God.
I mean, that happens in open water situations too, right?
Yep.
How many times have we been out of school of fish, and you know they're there. You can see, you know, forward view scoping has really changed that game completely. We know they're there.
Yep.
In a lot of cases, we know what they are. But we had an episode that you're going to see in the upcoming Fish in Canada season where we're one of the most frustrating days we've spent on the water. Because the area was loaded. It was absolutely loaded, and we just couldn't get them to bite.
Yeah, yes.
So fish it does happen.
Yeah.
It does happen. I think, you know, fishing is all about putting the odds in your favor, and in particular, ice fishing is about putting the odds in your favor. And so you've got to determine where the highest odds are for you to catch fish. If you drill a hole based on history, if you drill a hole based on nothing but you just kind of decided to stop and drill, the odds are not in your favor. You got to really, really get lucky to be able to.
Yeah. History, you know that's a great point. And I just experienced it. So that fish with Mikey there, that we were out on last Saturday in the boat, and we were out 2 weeks ago. So 2 weeks ago, we found the fish on our Garmin, and we found it via live scope and traditional screen both. And it's funny because we didn't have live bait at the time. We didn't have minnows because my buddy didn't have the minnows, the guy that sells the. So we went out there with plastics.
Oh,
and
boy.
Mikey, I had a plastic and Mikey had he was throwing a blade bait. Mm. And he broke off on a fish that he targeted on live scope. And we figured it might have been a pike. He later caught a nice pike, about an 8-pound pike. I saw two fish. Of all the whole fish we saw that whole day, there was two fish on the live scope that I saw, and I cast my plastic, jigging plastic out to, and I caught one. And it was a giant. It was 11-4. Yeah, on a jig. It's my biggest jig fish ever. Wow. But that's the only two fish we encountered the whole day with all those fish. The reason I'm going to tell you the story, a boat came along, and they saw where we were sitting. They knew we were onto something because we were sitting there working this area pretty good. They came in. They had live bait.
Oh, my God.
Dude, they started pop. They were catching them. We were watching them. We watched them catch like a limit each in front of us. And we're thinking, you idiots, where did they get those live bait? Fast forward 2 weeks later.
You go out there with live bait.
We're going to kick their ass, yeah, Angelo. Boy. Mikey and I get out there. The screen is void of fish. They were gone. And this is a very tried and true spot that's good for that. They were gone and we couldn't get a fish in that hole. We worked up and down from that area with jigs and minnows or with ice fishing jigs and minnows, the whole nine yards, and we couldn't get bit in there. Not one bite. They moved on us.
They move. That's it's a migration, right? And that's why I say if you could ever figure out
how you figure it out, I don't know.
But you still have to hit them at a point where they're
you have to intercept
they're feeding.
Them. You have to intercept them. Yeah, on a feed. Yeah,
on exactly. a feed because they don't necessarily eat while they're on the move either,
nope.
right?
No, they don't.
Those fish are going from point A to point B. Whatever motivates them to do that, food once again would probably be primary. While they're on the move, if you're not in point B, but somewhere in between, and you see those fish, that's when you break your heart because you see them.
Yeah.
And you're throwing everything but the kitchen sink, but they're not eating.
I honestly believe that.
They're not eating.
The open water fish we talked about, I think they're easier to catch in that case than the structure fish. The structure fish are locked on the bottom and they don't want to eat anything. Yeah. Those open water fish are always around food and they'll just every now and then, bop, I'll eat that. Oh, I'll get that. You know, that's why they eat these big, you know, minnow baits and stuff like that. Yeah. So I think they're actually easier to catch them when they're moving like that or you know, they're always hunting, I think, when they're open water. I don't think the structure fish are always hunting or the bottom fish are always hunting.
I think they're easier to fish if there's food in the area.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Right.
But they're rarely, at this time of year, rarely are they in an area where there's no food.
True. They're following.
You see the bait. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the key.
It's the key. To all of this that we're talking about, food is the key.
Yep.
You want to catch that fish, then you got to get them in the right spot at the right time. The right time being when there's food in the area, right?
Yeah.
And that's when it all comes together. That's when the magic happens. And that's also why it's always short-lived.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's why those moments happen, but they're like 10, 15 minutes, an hour max would be like I don't even know if an hour is even possible, to be honest with you, because they seem to move that much.
So, oh, yeah, you got to stay on them.
You have to stay on them. And so that's why ice fishing is so difficult. And not everybody does it for that same reason. It's pretty much sit there and you've made the commitment. You've drilled the hole. You've set up the tent. And you're committed. And that's the problem with that, Dean. Is that you? Was he sleeping?
No, he was right.
Oh, no, I'm taking notes.
That's the problem with that, is that you made the commitment and it's in your head. And you know what it was like to drill that hole, and you know what it was like to get the tent to stay up, and you know what it was all like pushing the snow off to the one side. And mm-hmm. you
that's
know
the problem with the hand auger.
Are you kidding
because
me?
Because then you're like, well, I don't really have to move if I have to do that again.
Exactly. And dull blades. And yeah.
That's the problem. 20 minutes
to drill a 6-inch hole. Like,
and that's the difference between ice fishing and open water fishing. In a boat, you can pursue those fish. And by the way, there's not a whole lot of difference between what we're talking about, fishing through the ice and following a migratory path. It's the same in open water. I mean, aside from, and not all bass, but aside from bass, who will be a little more predictable. I said that when we first started this piece. They're a little more predictable, and they're a little more apt to stay at home. Walleye don't do that. Whether it's winter or open water fishing, those guys move around. That's why you'll hear, you know, most walleye anglers, old timers, they troll for them. they just troll for them because to them it's movement, and they're going to hoping to intercept them in that right point in the migratory path. And the only way you can do that is open water fishing is to troll for them.
Yeah,
you know?
Now I've changed my way. Like, to this day, I still would rather catch them jigging than trolling, because it's just like that one I got, that big 11 plus on a jig. Dude, it was the most insane. Oh. It was so strong. Everything about it was
how deep?
About 22, 23 feet of water.
And you saw it on the Garmin?
Saw it on the scope. I saw two fish on the scope between 50 and 60 feet. And this is right after Mikey broke off. He says, here, go up and take the live scopes. I said, okay. And I just fired out. I fired one cast out there.
Oh, he must have been so pissed off.
But he wasn't, because the fish was so grossly big. We couldn't believe how big it was. And it ate the jig right down. And I felt that line tinging off his teeth. You know, the walleye's teeth are pulled in. They're sharp, and they're all pulled in like that. Tick, 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 tick. The whole fight in. And we just kept, and I had an 8-pound Yozuri fluorocarbon on. And it held perfectly, but I was just dying, especially when we saw the fish at first. But my point is that I would love to catch, like, I would rather catch two fish jigging than five fish trolling. But the reality is, the more and more I'm doing this late season stuff, trolling is the best way of doing it. Trolling is still your best way of going out and catching these fish. Like Dan said, you're covering all
that
water.
You're covering that hole,
especially if you don't know where they are when you're jigging. At least in the trolling stuff, I can pick a spot like the traditional Adolphus reach. We'll go out there and we'll look for the bait and we'll look for the fish and just say, you know what, let's suck it up and let's just drag the Yozuris in there 2 mile an hour, and you know you're going to get bit, or you're pretty sure you're going to get bit, right? So, and chances are one's going to look like that too, or more than one's going to look like that too. Yeah. So I'm not a real troller in the sense of like that, like, you know me. I mean, I'm like you with the casting and all that stuff with bass and all that. It goes with walleye too. But when push comes to shove, I think nowadays you're better off picking that trolling, you know, trolling gig.
You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
Right. You got to do. You can't be one dimensional in fishing. I think the most successful anglers will tell you that there is no secret pattern. There is no secret bait. There is no secret time. There is no nothing.
Look at the muskie guys, the trollers versus the casters. You know what I mean? They all want to catch them casting, but they all say, I think we got to troll them up. I think we got to get that giant trolling sort of thing. Yeah. Right. So,
would you prefer to have, just a curiosity, a 2-bite day if they were
giant
fish? Or would you prefer to have a day where you're catching fish every, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes?
Yeah, that's a good one, especially this
time.
And they're smaller. Yeah. For jigging, at this time of year, I take the multiple fish all day long. Like, that giant I got was great. But It's a long day. When it's, a long it's the only wall I've got all day.
It's a long
day. It's a long day. So I would definitely take that bum, 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 because Mike and I talked about, God, used to be the days. We used to get those. What happened to those days where tap, 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 tap? We'd got tons of them all day long jigging. You know what I mean? So I would, by knowing how good that was, absolutely, I'd take that over. Now would I take the all day, when I was out, if I'm out trolling, those two giants out trolling versus a bunch, I don't know, because I'm kind of out there for that giant too, but it's boring too, right? Like that trolling can be boring as hell too. Oh. So I don't know. That's a good one for the trolling. Jigging, definitely lots of fish. I'd be mixed on the trolling. You?
Big fish.
Yeah.
I would much rather.
No kidding.
Sit there.
Even on the jigging, like just sitting there all day long, you're going to get two fish, but you know they're going to be good ones.
Depends on my frame of mind and what I went out to do, right? If I went out to
how cold it was out there.
Well, sure, all that stuff, right? If I went out with big fish in mind, targeting big fish in mind, yeah, I don't care whether I get one fish. I don't care whether I get multiple small fish versus why I'd rather have the one.
Mm-hmm.
Which, without question.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just to me, it changes the dynamics. And then every once in a while, of course, you have that magic day where you get a ton of big fish. That's the goal ultimate, for every
the
angler.
The epitome of it all, for sure. And that can happen at this time of year, too, from here on to the ice.
Oh.
And that, you'll never have a better chance at giant fish and more giant fish than ever than this time of year.
We interrupt this program to bring you the much-anticipated bonus code for the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. This week's code is TROLLING. That's TROLLING, TROLLING, all caps. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 free entries towards all our current giveaways. For those who haven't entered yet, what the heck are you waiting for? Head on over to fishingcanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode. Click contests and sign up for all the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. And now, back to the show. How big a role, in your opinion, and once again, let's take Bay of Quinte out of this scenario because I don't really think it applies because it is so unique. But we're talking inland lakes. We're talking smaller lakes where you know that there are a good population of walleye. How big do you think weed growth plays under the ice?
I think it's very important. To me, it's very important. Only the little ice fishing that I've done and the little late season open water fishing that I've done on multiple species, including largemouth bass, largemouth pike, and walleye, I think weed growth is very important. Even you keep hearing about this stuff about dead weeds. These dead weeds give off carbon dioxide or whatever like that.
I know.
I find that fish still hang around that area. Maybe they're not right in that thick weed patch, but they're close to the edge of those weeds. But if you can find green weeds, because green weeds do grow under the ice. People don't understand that one. People don't believe
that. Big time.
A lot of times green weeds, and if you can find that, I think it's great for those weedy type of lakes, those rock and weed lakes like that. I think it's a fantastic spot. If you can set up on a point of green weeds for walleye from before ice and right onto the ice.
And once again, it's food.
Yep.
It's all food related.
Yeah, there's perch around there usually.
If there's food in the green weeds and there's food floating around, swimming around in the main basin of the lake, I think walleye would be susceptible to being caught in either one of those areas because mm-hmm. they're focused on food.
Yeah.
Once again, it all goes back to food. I think if there was a way that we could magically, if Garmin comes out with a unit that detects food, it's going to be a winner. Yeah, I don't know how it would do it, but if they somehow come up with a technology that makes it easier for us to find food in that lake, I think fishing will become such a simple pastime as opposed to a complicated one.
Yeah.
It's complicated now.
Sure it is.
It's complicated. And the reason it's complicated, we're trying to figure out the predator fish. We're trying to see, okay, where is he apt to be today? Well, we just mentioned green weeds under the ice are a key. We mentioned that sometimes they're in open water. We mentioned all kinds of things based on the predator But I keep going back to food. If we can find the food, you know, you and I both are big on looking for some kind of fish holding structure in a body of water. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing we'll look for in midsummer, right? All right, let's find that ideal structure. But we're doing it because we say, well, while I love those underwater humps, they love those long tapering points. They love. But why do they love it? They love it because of food. Yeah. And if we started just changing the way we look at fishing and start learning, I've said this before in these podcasts, if we spent the amount of time researching bait fish as we do predator fish, I think our overall fishing would improve tenfold. If we knew, because I don't know what triggers minnows to move from shallow to deep, what triggers bait fish to school up in balls out in the middle of the lake, what triggers I have no idea. All I know is that whenever we find them, there's predator fish down below they're looking to eat them. So if you could just think about that, how if we knew as much about dace and all the, you know, emerald shiners and whatever, Cisco,
scalp and everything,
our fishing would become that much easier.
Yeah, because we do look for bait, and when you find it, you say, oh, there's bait.
There's bait. There's a lot easier right there.
Now with the live, with the forward viewing, live scope in our case, it is easier for sure to find bait versus your traditional screen.
Right? I even have a buddy out west who's detecting crominid hatches on live scope.
Oh, yeah. You were telling me that. That's
pretty dialed in.
Why couldn't, think about that.
Yeah.
Think about that. How simple.
So if you could predict it, because we have the tools right now. Like LiveScope is a tool to find bait. You need to know how to predict. Okay, they're going to be over here somewhere. Now you drop your thing.
Exactly.
Oh, there it is. There she be.
But right? If you knew that in the month of May, there's a hatch of whatever on that body of water, and what that hatch needs in order for it to perpetuate itself, right, and continue that cycle, then you go look for. I told you 1 year. During the old tournament, the Canada-US Walleye Tournament, that Reno and I found walleye in, I think it was 26 or 28 feet of water. We didn't know till later exactly what it was, but it was the mayfly hatch.
Right.
And that was a basin of mud in 26, 28 feet of water.
Yeah.
And we hit it just at the right. We had no idea.
What did you use to catch those fish?
Oh, God. We started out just with conventional stuff, but then by the end of the tournament, we had narrowed it down to little marabou, black marabou jigs.
Okay, so you look like that little mayfly-ish.
Yeah, once we found out, we're getting close to what, you know, knowing what it was, then we fine-tuned our baits, my God. But it was crazy. And what was happening, while I were sitting over top of this basin, this little hole that was no more than 50 feet in circumference, but it was in 26 or 28 feet of water. It was a definite bowl, but it was full of mud. And this is where the mayflies were coming up. Once they broke through as larvae and they broke through, they would come up to the surface. And on the way up, these walleye, schools of walleye had surrounded this bowl and they were just waiting for them to pop up, and they were eating like crazy.
And they won't eat other stuff, will they? Like you control, you control the Yuzuri through there and they won't even look at
you. They won't even look at you.
Yeah.
Because at that particular point in time,
their head is right on that mayfly.
They're focused on that. So that's why I say, if we could better understand that, if we spent the time and did the research on a body of water, and it's the infrastructure of food on that body of water, and found out when and where, our fishing would become an absolute dream.
Yeah.
Because we wouldn't waste the time that we waste.
Yeah, maybe the biologists might know. Maybe we need to buddy up with some of those guys. And
I don't know. It doesn't seem to be a real group out there that's studying food.
Fly guys are better at it, I think. They pay way more attention, but they have to because you have to be so tuned in. There's in the conventional world that there's not really anybody who's like
on a mental pattern.
It is weird that no one is,
but that would be the key.
Yeah,
because it is the key. Fish, they need to reproduce themselves, and in order to do that, they have to stay healthy by eating. That's it. That's all they do in life.
Yeah.
So we've already isolated the reproduction part. If we know where the primary reproduction area is on a lake, that's going to be a big key because it tells us where to start. I'm mapping them out, right? All we have to do now is figure out how the food base works on that lake to understand that migration that takes place every day. And nobody, yeah, you're right, nobody's doing it, right? Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time in creating all these wonderful baits and colors and sizes and shapes and hell.
It's all about the fish.
We throw them in lake. Listen, I don't care what anybody says. I'll bet you 75% of the baits that we use, I'm talking we, the colors and shapes of those baits are not even prevalent in that body of water.
Oh, God. Look at that. Look at that.
There you go.
The bottom one is a perch. That would be the closest one.
That's it.
To there.
Well, we don't know the size or the true shape. And by the way, that's not a real perch shape anyways.
No. But it's a perch color, but it's not a perch shape.
It's shaped that way because that's what gives it that nice movement.
Action, right?
So, I don't know. It's just a thing I've had in my head forever. I think
going back to that weed thought, though, I have a feeling that bait going to minnows and that still hide in the dead weeds.
For sure.
It's just something for them to hide out from. They might move out of there if it's given carbon dioxide or whatever the problem is with that. I don't know the theory behind that, but I know if there's a hiding area for minnows to go into, they're going to go into those dead weeds to hide and then come back out when the predators are gone. And the reason I say that is because especially with pike and largemouth, I got a couple lakes that I work with, and I've seen it when the water temperatures hit in the 40s and below. So that sounds really cold for largemouth, and it is cold for largemouth, but it doesn't stop them from moving. And then running live scope, and I'm running these weed beds and these weed areas, and I'm seeing all kinds of activity from all these fish that are in this dead weed area. They aren't even alive. They're just in the edge. They're working in and out and all around that, and they are using those weeds, you know, at this time of year. So I know the walleye would be too. And if there was a green weeds, as you said, but even if it's dead weeds, if you find that weed bed, they're using, those fish still use that stuff, even if it's dead.
We use something at certain times of year to help us when we're faced with cold fronts. And I think fishing through the ice is no different than this. And we use zooplankton or phytoplankton or microscopic food sources as our key, because we say when they are not able to reproduce on a 24-hour cycle, which would be normal for them, everything changes in the water column in terms of its aggressiveness or activity. If the cycle isn't happening with microscopic food, then the next level predator knows and it shuts down and the next one shuts down and the next one is a chain reaction. They know that until things settle down and that reproduction cycle of microscopic food is back to normal, then everybody kind of says, let's not use a whole lot of energy. Well, how about that in terms of ice fishing?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the
Well, zooplankton doesn't work. Just die. It doesn't. It's still existent under the ice.
Yeah.
But has anybody ever really done any studies? Has looked at that? Because that might be the key to all this thing. You mentioned dead weeds or green weeds. There'll still be some kind of activity in there. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe if we knew more about microscopic food source, which every one of these, from the little minnow up to the big giant predator, every one of them is connected to this microscopic food source. Well, maybe that would be the key in ice fishing. Maybe we need to better understand how that part of the equation deals with frozen water.
Is there as much breeding, I guess, I don't know what you call it, the hatching activity in 30-degree water as there is in 60 or 70-degree water, right? You know what I mean? There might be a big difference in just that alone. Who knows where they do it, where it happens.
Or maybe no difference.
That's what I mean. It might be no difference at all.
Because as far as I know, what triggers them in open water is barometric pressure as opposed to temperature. Yeah, it's really not temperature related.
You think they'd be the least affected of everything under there, maybe. They might be hardly any effect.
Maybe there's no effect at all. I don't know.
Because these fish don't, like, people think fish hibernate and oh my God, they don't do that in the cold water. Now, granted, I mean, once it gets to February and you're on a lake where there's smallmouth bass and they've grouped up in that 30, 35 foot of water. Yeah, they get down there and get dormant on a lot of days, but they don't stop feeding. They all of a sudden
have to eat.
It triggers and they have to eat a little bit or whatever like that. So they don't all go as walleye. And that's not the case at all. Walleye just keep going through the winter, right? They don't go dormant at all. They're always moving and eating. They're a feisty little fish. They are. Those fish
I'd
species.
Be curious to find out what happens to the microscopic.
Yeah.
Food.
Yeah, because that gets where your minnows. That's where your minerals are going. That's, right where that stuff is. Right.
That's where the perch are going to go. Where the minnows go.
Yeah.
And that's where the walleye is going to be. Where the perch goes. Right.
It's
so if we could figure out how that.
Dean's already looking it up, aren't you, Dean?
Works.
I will be.
Oh, you will be.
How that works. I mean, because that's that movement. You know, we talk about that movement. Sometimes it's 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and those fish are on the move. Or better yet, they're there and they won't bite. Well, maybe it's all based on the same things that we experience in open water. And that is, well, we can see that there's a system moving in, the barometer is moving up or down. Well, okay, we know that things are going to change, so let's change our tactic on catching fish. But maybe we're not doing that through the ice because we don't think.
And if it's on a daily basis, you got to be on the right day because those other 2 days after or before, whatever,
exactly.
There's nothing happening.
There you go.
Nothing happening at all. All of a sudden, that one day, the zooplankton is going crazy. Everything's going crazy. Yeah, you might be right.
It's something to look into if you're into wanting to learn more about how to catch fish. You got to get down to the basics, and the basics for them, it's food. And I think through the ice, if somebody starts studying phytoplankton, zooplankton, all of those microscopic little creatures, I think it'll make a change.
Hmm.
There you go.
Interesting.
That or it.
I like that.
I just blew my wad on that one.
I love it. I love it. Oh, God. Anyways, yeah, this is a great time of year to still be out there. Safety is a huge concern. You know, your boat, if your boat is insured, number one, you want to make sure if you don't care, some people don't care. A lot of people say, that's okay. I'm not going to do it. That's up to you. But make sure you're dressed warm, obviously. Definitely flotation of some type or other.
That's come a long way, right?
Oh, my God. The flotation suits nowadays. And you know what? This is the time. If you're an ice fisherman, you probably already own a flotation suit because the ones that they're making nowadays are great. It's not the big old, I mean, that Mustang is still the be all end all. It's the best of the best, but there's a lot of them now are, you know, bibs and coats and they're very thin and they work really, really well. But you have to keep safety in mind. You know, those little hand warmers, put those little hand warmers in your gloves, put the foot warmers or hand warmers in your boots because you're going to need them. I don't care what you say. It's a warm day out there this time of year would be 8 degrees, you know, Celsius. So, and
that's,
a lot of times,
cool.
Yeah, a lot of times it's less than 5. And if they got a wind chill going on there, I've seen so many times where the boat was covered in ice. We've been out there stupidly, but the waves get big and you're thinking, oh, it's only going to be +3 or +4. We can do it. But when your boat turns to ice, the sheet of ice, and you're in trouble.
Cold. And then a lot of guys will want to do it at night.
Yeah.
That's just adds a whole.
I've never done that one out in the boat and late fall like that. You did.
Remember?
It at Belleville. I wasn't there.
Mikey
No, Mikey and I talked about that the other day. He said that your boat, you hit the wave and a sheet of ice just formed right in front of your boat.
It adds a whole other element to danger.
Right? Yeah.
Quick little tip. We've talked about it in the past and we've had it on fishingcanada.com, but just a quick little reminder. When you're confronted with the elements that Pete just spoke about, one of the first things that happens is your hands. Your hands are non-functioning.
Oh my God.
Do things like tie on baits. You can't do things like they just become a real problem, whether they're in gloves or not in gloves. One of the great little tip that our Gord Pizer turned us on to, 25 years ago at least on the radio show, was to take those little hand warmers, the little packaged hand warmers.
Yeah, those ones I was just talking about. There.
Yep.
Yeah.
But rather than put them in your gloves or in your pocket and warm your hands, try to warm all of your appendages in a glove or in your pocket with one little hand warmer. If you wear little wristbands, those little terry wristbands that weightlifters and stuff will often have on, just a wristband, put that heating pouch underneath the wristband against the bottom of your wrist here, where the majority of the blood flows through into your hand. And it will blow your mind what happens. You can have no gloves on and still use your fingers. It just takes the cold away from the ends of your fingers because the blood is being warmed by the little hand warmer.
It's smart. It's a smart thing. Right? But I've tried it in the real cold stuff, and it doesn't work for me in the real, real cold stuff.
If it gets
stuff.
Really bad.
If it's like that plus, you know, like plus 10, plus 8, that's good. That's when it works.
And that's when it works, right.
You can bare hand fishing. Yeah. But I found that, you know, another one that's really good, if people ever, or you ever see them, there's little pouches. Usually they're hunters who have them. They're camouflage. But you put your hand, you put two hand warmers in those pouches and you put them in early in the day.
That helps.
And I'll tell you, when you have to touch a fish with your, you know, your minnows, you're getting minnows, you touch your minnow, you touch the fish for a picture, whatever you're doing, your hands get so damn cold when they get wet. But you dry them off as best you can, you stick them in that pouch and just grab a hold of those two things, and that will bring you back. Because sometimes you go beyond, right?
There's and of course, knowing you as well as I know you, I'm sure that the minute you get home that night, you take that hand warmer, you turn it inside out, you put it in the washing machine and get all of that fish of guts and everything. Okay, no, I'm just saying, I know.
Once a month, whether it needs well it or enough. Not.
Once a year, if it needs
so
it or not.
So nice in there. It's like a little kangaroo pouch. So warm. Oh, God. But it does work well. I'll tell you that. So, but that the wrist warmer thing is great for when you're in that plus 10, plus
just
8.
So that, just,
it takes the edge off. And you can have them there anyways. And then you get up there all day and then put them more in your mitts afterwards to help you.
It just makes a huge difference because if you think about it, all the blood that's rushing through here is what's going into your hand.
Yeah.
If you can heat it up in that nice narrow area where it's all concentrated,
mm-hmm.
It just makes things that much easier, and you can move. Anyways, just one of the many things that
good
we
tip.
Learned from experience.
Yes, sir.
And experienced people.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
Well, there too. Is a bit of that, too.
Yeah, every now and then.
By the way, if you want one of these beautiful shirts, a bunch of bullshit, they will be available by the time this airs. I think they will be up and available.
And there's not a lot of them, so you got to act pretty quick.
No, I know.
It'd be a good little Christmas gift, folks. It'd be a great little...
And it's got the logo somewhere.
The Outdoor Journal logo on the bottom. It's on this side here, I think. Isn't it? Right there. I see it. There it is, hidden. Hidden from y'all. Right
there. And it's just a cool item.
Yes.
All right. We got to move on here. What are we going to be here all day? I got pasta waiting for me, for God's sakes.
You do?
No. I wish I could...
I was going to say, can you bring some in for the team here after?
Wishful thing.
The leftovers?
Want to remind everybody about the contest, the ever-present contest on fishingcanada.com.
Come on now.
I don't know what's up there right now, but I'm sure that there are...
A live scope.
There's a live scope.
Plus ice kit.
Did you hear this? A live scope plus ice kit right now. Available to be won. When is that going to be?
Just after the new year, the week we're back. Yeah.
Wow. What a prize.
What
package.
A great prize.
We use that kit through the ice and in the open water, just to let everybody know. It's not just say, hey, here's something nice for you. It's something we use a lot of. And we've
can't
got
live,
a lot of
can't
fish.
Live without.
Oh, my God.
What's the value of that kit?
Oh, it's like $4,000 or more.
Between four and five.
Might be more than that, yeah.
Between
yeah.
$4,000 and $5,000. Anyway, somebody is going to be very happy early January.
Yeah, get your votes in there. Not your votes, your contest ballots in there.
All you need to do is put in your email and you're in. So nice and
wow,
easy.
Wow, what a great prize, folks.
Yep.
What do you mean? All you have to do is put it in your email.
Well, if you put in your email in the contest, you get an entry.
Put your email.
It helps. Now
I'm confused. I thought they had to fill out a ballot and stuff. No,
they put their name in their email and that's it.
That's it.
Yep, that's all.
Oh
you have
my
to do.
God.
Yeah, we make it easy.
Oh man, my God,
we're a live scope kit.
Yep.
Woo.
They go to fishcan.com to the contest button.
Yep.
And once they're there, all they have to do is put in their email.
Yep. If you're listening to this podcast, you've already heard the bonus code. You type that in, you'll get 100 entries. So if you
hello,
yeah.
And how often can they enter?
They can enter as many times as they want.
Oh, there's no 24-hour deadline? Like
every day you're allowed to enter again, but there's lots of things you can do. If you check out an article, you get an entry. If you listen to a podcast, you get an entry.
God.
We give you lots of opportunity.
It's worth it. I mean, we're trying to get to our website ultimately. Absolutely. We want some engagement, but I'll tell you what, folks, for a prize like this, wow, that's awesome.
It don't get much better than that is all I got to say.
No.
That are it for us. We got to wrap this baby up on behalf of the entire Outdoor Journal crew. Vova, thank you. Nick, hopefully you're doing well today. Nick is a little under the weather, but he's still probably doing well. Dean Taylor.
Come on now.
My good buddy Peter Bowman. I'm Angelo Biola. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time.